This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margo Patterson. We'll be airing a program from our archive today, my November 9th conversation with the well-known historian Rashid Haladi. We'll be talking about the war in Gaza and the background to it. But first, news. Israel's relentless siege and bombardment of Gaza continued over the Christmas holiday, with 250 Palestinians killed over the Christmas weekend and twice that number injured. The dead include 70 killed in a strike on a refugee camp in central Gaza. Also over the holiday weekend, Israeli forces staged raids in the occupied West Bank cities of Jenin, Nablus, Bethlehem, Jericho, and Ramallah. Raids have continued in subsequent days, with 6 Palestinian youths killed in a drone attack on a refugee camp outside Tul Karim, December 27th. 4 Palestinians were injured in that attack, 1 critically. The ambulance carrying the injured to receive medical treatment was delayed by occupation authorities for more than an hour. The head of the Tul Karim Doctors Syndicate said an Israeli army soldier stabbed one of the injured inside the ambulance. He said other injured passengers were kicked, punched, beaten with rifles, and threatened with death. The occupation forces bulldozed infrastructure in the main streets of the Nur Shams refugee camp and stormed citizens' homes in various neighborhoods of the camp. Also on December 27th, thousands of Palestinian families fled Israel's expanding ground offensive in central and southern Gaza. They streamed into the town of Deir el-Balah, which has been overwhelmed by several hundreds of thousands of people driven from the north. The Associated Press reports Israeli offensives are crowding most of the population into Deir el-Balah and Rafah at the territory's southern edge, as well as a tiny rural area by the southern coastline. But these areas continue to be hit by Israeli strikes that regularly crush homes full of people. In Bethlehem, city and church leaders canceled traditional Christmas celebrations to mourn the more than 20,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza. A nativity scene erected by the well-known Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, showing baby Jesus lying in the middle of the rubble of war, drew international attention. So too did a sermon by Pastor Munther Isaac called Christ in the Rubble, a Litany of Lament. Reverend Isaac delivered a message to the world, speaking out against the racism and hypocrisy of Western nations. This war has confirmed to us that the world does not see us as equal. Maybe it's the color of our skin, even our kinship to Christ does not shield us. We are not human in their eyes, he said. Munther also criticized Western churches, which he said have been complicit in genocide. If we, as Christians, are not outraged by the genocide, by the weaponization of the Bible to justify it, there is something wrong with our Christian witness, and we are compromising the credibility of our gospel message, Munther said. He said the silence of Western churches is complicity. In normal times, Bethlehem is filled with throngs of foreign tourists. Tourism accounts for 70% of the town's income, most of it occurring during the Christmas season. Reporters in Bethlehem Christmas Eve described the usually bustling manger square as a ghost town. Israel's top general said on December 26 that Israel's war on Gaza will go on for many months, even as a string of incidents highlighted the danger of the war spreading. Yemen's Houthi militia claimed responsibility for a missile attack that day on a container ship in the Red Sea and for an attempt to attack Israel with drones. The Houthis have been attacking ships they say have links to Israel and the entrance to the Red Sea, one of the world's busiest shipping lanes. The militia say the attacks are a response to Israel's assault on Gaza. On December 25th, an Israeli airstrike killed a senior leader of Iran's Revolutionary Guards in Syria. And on the Lebanon border, December 26th, Israel said Hezbollah fired anti-tank missiles at a church, wounding 9 Israeli soldiers and a civilian. On Wednesday, December 27th, Israel's foreign minister warned Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah that he might be Israel's next target. It was reported Wednesday that overnight, 1 Hezbollah fighter and 2 civilians, a newlywed couple, were killed in an overnight Israeli strike on a family-owned residential building in South Lebanon. More than 150 people have been killed on the Lebanese side in the clashes between Israel and Hezbollah, most of them fighters with Hezbollah and allied groups, but also including at least 19 civilians.
Mm-hmm.
My guest today is Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University. He is a historian of the modern Middle East and the author of 7 books, including The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood, Brokers of Deceit, How the United States Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East, and most recently, The 100 Years War on Palestine. He's written articles and op-eds for a wide range of newspapers, been interviewed on the PBS NewsHour, Nightline, The Charlie Rose Show, the BBC, and other outlets, and advised the Palestinian delegation at the Madrid Conference in 1991. Rashid Khalidi, welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine.
Thanks so much for having me.
Professor Khalidi, your most recent book was The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonial Conquest and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. Could you talk about the war going on in Gaza and situate it within the context of this 100 Years War on Palestine that your book describes?
I think that the current war does actually fit into the framing that I try to provide in the book. Because what I argue is that this is not just a conflict between two national groups, which it is, of course. You have Israelis, modern nation, state, and you have Palestinians, a people. So you have a national aspect of the struggle. It is also a struggle over a piece of land, which one group, which is to say the Zionist movement and later the State of Israel, has been trying to settle and expand within at the expense of the indigenous population. This is something that early Zionist leaders recognized. They saw themselves as both a national movement with rights going back to the Bible, but at the same time saw themselves as European settlers and colonists. And the more far-sighted, and in my view, the franker amongst them, people like Zev Jabotinsky, explicitly said, we understand that these people will fight to prevent our transformation of Palestine into the land of Israel. And I think that that demographic push to transform what was once Palestine with an Arab, mainly Arab population, into Israel with a mainly Jewish population is behind a lot of what has happened over the past 100 and more years, and is a little bit of what we're seeing here in Gaza, in the sense that Israel has now pushed a very large part of the population of Gaza, most of whom are refugees pushed into the Gaza Strip back in 1948. Pushed those people from the northern parts of Gaza into the southern parts of Gaza. And that is yet another stage in a process of ethnic cleansing, depopulation, which goes back to 1948. So I think that what's happening in Gaza, it has its own specific antecedents, the attack by Hamas on Israel on the 7th, the killing of Israeli civilians, and then the Israeli operation that's been ongoing, which has killed 10,500 Palestinians, mainly civilians. I think it has to be fitted into that context.
You've said in a recent article that you think Secretary of State Blinken has been visiting Arab countries trying to serve the goal of expelling Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. What leads you to conclude that? One question. And then that would be a major war crime. I imagine that U.S. collaboration in that effort would further damage U.S. standing. Why would the United States want to aid Israel in expelling Palestinians? What are some of the consequences to be expected should that happen?
I think that the question is not why. The question is, did they? And I think there's a good bit of evidence that they did. Why they would do it, one presumes that this is something that Israel wanted the United States to mediate and ask the United States to talk to Egypt and Jordan about. The evidence is pretty conclusive. One piece of evidence is the outraged Egyptian rejections of any expulsion of Palestinians into Egyptian territory. And those were directed at Blinken. If the United States weren't asking on behalf of Israel for that, why would the Egyptians be protesting so loudly? Why would the Jordanians be saying things along the same lines? Why would the Saudis, who presumably were asked to finance this, be protesting as well? That's one piece of evidence. The other piece of evidence is the White House request through the Office of Management and Budget to Congress on October 20th for the $10+ billion that are supposed to go to Israel and which are currently hung up in Congress. And if you look at the section under Migration and Refugee Assistance, it says these resources would support displaced and conflict-affected civilians, including Palestinian refugees in Gaza and the West Bank, and to address potential needs of citizens fleeing to neighboring countries. In other words, what the White House is asking is for some of this money to be used for Palestinians who would, quote, flee to neighboring countries. It goes on to say the crisis could well result in displacement across borders, meaning into Egypt or into Jordan, perhaps, and higher regional humanitarian needs, and funding may be used to meet evolving program requirements outside of Gaza. Now, this provoked presumably whatever Secretary Blinken and other American diplomats said to the Egyptian government provoked a ferocious Egyptian response. And what Blinken and his other State Department officials may have said to the Jordanian king provoked an equally ferocious response, to the extent that a few days later, the president was obliged to have a talk with President Sisi, and the readout of the Biden-Sisi meeting said they discussed the importance of protecting civilian lives, respect for international humanitarian law, and ensuring that Palestinians are not displaced to Egypt or any other nation. Why would the president and Sisi be talking about that if it had not been on the table between the two countries? So I think the evidence is pretty clear. Israeli government ministers have said all over the map, we would love to get these people out. And it appears that the United States was willing to facilitate that.
The United States has been providing unconditional rhetorical, military, and diplomatic support to Israel, enabling it to resist pressure for a ceasefire or even a humanitarian pause, and to continue its assault on Gaza that has now killed more than 10,000 people, most of them civilians. What is U.S. strategy in all of this? Does it have a strategy? It's unconditional support for Israel's bombing and Israel's withholding of food, water, and fuel from the population is damaging the U.S. reputation in the world and making President Biden's talk of a rules-based order seem very hollow. Why is the Biden administration doing all of this, and what is its endgame?
The why is easier to respond to than what their endgame is, I think. Why, I think, has first to do with the president's very deep attachment to Israel, which goes back to things that he's been talking about for decades. He talks about having met Golda Meir. He talks about his relationship with Israeli leaders Sharon and Netanyahu himself. It's pretty clear from things that he says that he is of a generation that accepted pretty much the entire self-view of Israel as a miracle created out of the desert, as a response to the Holocaust, making the desert bloom, only democracy in the Middle East, all of the sort of slogans that Israel has used for many, many, many years, and is not really in touch with the Israel of 2023, which has some of the most extremist, self-proclaimed Jewish supremacist ministers in key positions, and which is not the Israel of Golda Meir, however good or bad that may have been. So I think that's one reason. The president himself has a deep ideological commitment to Israel. A second reason for the why, I think, has to do with a sense that Israel is an American ally, and Israel is a country that the United States has always stood by in this region. It is an ally in a region in which the United States sees itself as not just opposition to Iran, but in a ferocious rivalry. And I think that there's a strategic motive here. Israel is a strategic ally vis-a-vis Iran, even though both President Obama and President Biden have tried to somewhat ameliorate relations with Iran. They both see Iran as a dangerous rival. And Israel is an ally there.
Is Iran really that dangerous? It's not a superpower. It's not really a threat to the United States, is it?
It may be a threat to some U.S. interests. And it's seen by some U.S. allies as a threat to U.S. interests or a threat to their interests. So Saudi Arabia in the past, much less now that there's been a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, brokered by, of all countries, China. But Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries have always been concerned about Iranian power and influence. That's also true of Israel. And I think that that standing by your allies principle is something that moves Biden as much as his commitment to Israel itself. I think the more interesting question is, what's the end game? What does the Biden administration think is going to come out of this? Now, you've mentioned something which is one of the important things that is already coming out of this, which is an enormous decrease in American influence in the region. In my book, In the 100 Years War, what I point out is it was not the Zionist movement and the Palestinians. It was the Zionist movement backed by the British Empire. It was the Zionist movement backed by the United States and the Soviet Union during the time that the UN adopted a partition resolution in 1947. It's been Israel backed by external powers. And the war that Israel is fighting is being fought with American artillery, American planes, and American resupply of munitions. We are fighting this war with Israel, we the United States. It's not just our tax dollars. It's our weapons. This is an argument I make throughout the book. It's not just the Palestinians and the Israelis, or the Israelis versus the Arabs. The perplexing thing for me is how the administration sees this is going to end. Israel devastates Gaza. Israel forces half the population out. Israel presumably thinks it can defeat Hamas militarily. Now, can it eliminate Hamas, quote unquote? No. Hamas is a political movement. Hamas is an ideological movement. Hamas is a movement that has been fed, supported, reinforced, enhanced by the absolute failure of the American-sponsored peace process over the past 30 years. If the United States had been able, between the Madrid Peace Conference in 1991 and 2023, to end occupation, limit Israeli settlements in the occupied territories, and create a Palestinian state, Hamas would have no leg to stand on. It had no leg to stand on in the 1990s when people thought that that was what the Oslo process was going to do. That is not what it did. In fact, that is not what it was intended to do. And that is not what it has done up till now. The United States has not achieved or allowed the achievement of Israel and the United States, have not allowed the achievement of even the most minimal Palestinian national ambitions. Therefore, Hamas is powerful. Why? Because it's argued against this whole process. Were this process to have succeeded in the 90s, we would be in a different world. Hamas really would not have had a leg to stand in arguing for continued armed struggle, more violence, and so on and so forth.
If you're just joining us, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, and I'm talking to historian Rashid Khalidi about the historical background to the war in Gaza. I want to ask you more about your statement that the United States has undermined peace. Could you talk about how the United States has done that over the years?
It goes quite a ways back. And by peace, I'm not talking about peace in the Middle East generally. The United States has helped to broker peace between Israel and Jordan. The United States was instrumental in bringing about peace between Egypt and Israel. The United States, on two occasions, came very close to brokering a peace treaty between Israel and Syria. So the United States has actually tried to bring about peace in the Middle East if you're talking about peace between Israel and the Arab countries. And it succeeded or helped to succeed in two cases and came very, very close in the 90s and early 2000s with Syria. I'm talking about Palestine, which, of course, is the core of the problem. Before there was an Arab-Israeli dispute between Arab countries and Israel, there was a conflict in Palestine. There was a struggle going on over Palestine before 1948, before the 1948 war. This conflict the United States has exacerbated by taking Israel's side completely. I would argue that if you look at all American initiatives, certainly from the time of the Madrid and then Oslo processes, right up to the present, it's in the power of the United States to do much, much more to achieve Palestinian statehood, which is supposedly what the United States wants, to end occupation and to roll back the settlement process. And it simply has not done that. To say the United States is helpless vis-a-vis Israel is actually false. When American vital national interests were considered to be involved, like during the Cold War, when Kissinger wanted to force Israel to disengage after the 73 war, he forced Israel to do what the United States wanted against the wishes of the Israeli government, the Israeli military. When the United States wanted to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia against Israeli wishes, it did so. When President Obama wanted to limit Iran's nuclear ambitions through the JCPOA, he did so over the opposition of Israel. So the United States can make Israel do things, or at least do things irrespective of what the Israelis want or say they want. But on Palestine, that's not been the case. So my point is not the United States hasn't made peace in the Middle East. It has, and so far as those cases I talked about, it's that where Palestine is concerned, they have not been willing to do anything of that sort.
And why?
Well, multiple reasons. First is, I don't think they see that a major American strategic interest is involved. Selling enormous numbers and quantities of weapons at vast, vast, vast cost to Gulf countries is a national interest, as far as American strategists are concerned. Opposing Iran or trying to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon via agreements with Iran is a vital American national interest. Winning the Cold War by winning Egypt over to the American side via forcing Israel out of Sinai was in the American national interest. And Israeli governments didn't want to do it. And they were forced by the United States to do it. And I'm talking about the governments that Kissinger dealt with back in the early 70s. And I'm talking about the governments that President Carter brought to the table at Camp David in 1978. I think that where Palestine is concerned, there's a blindness on the part of American policymakers who don't seem to see that what happens in Palestine has an enormous impact on the rest of the Arab world. These people drug themselves into believing that the Arabs don't care about Palestine. Well, maybe Arab governments, corrupt, undemocratic, unrepresentative, kleptocratic Arab governments don't care about Palestine. They care about keeping their bread buttered where Washington and Israel are concerned. But Arab peoples do. And here we see them over the past month forcing their governments to take stands that they didn't take a month and a half ago. And that shows how foolish the vision in Washington of skipping over the Palestine question, skipping over the Palestinians, and just trying to normalize things and say, well, we throw a few crumbs to them and that will suffice. That's obviously a mistaken perception of the importance of Palestine to people in the Arab world. And that should be seen as a strategic interest of the United States. I don't believe that it is as fully as it should be in Washington.
This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Oslo Accords, the agreement between the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Israel that established the Palestinian Authority and was supposed to end in the establishment of a Palestinian state. You were an advisor at the Madrid Conference, another peace initiative that occurred 2 years earlier after the first Gulf War. Looking back, what went wrong with these initiatives that seemed promising and hopeful?
We all were hopeful at the time of Madrid. And I was an advisor to the delegation that went to Madrid and then continued in negotiations that took place in Washington in the basement of the State Department for the following 2 years until the summer of 1993. By 1993, it was clear to all of us, I think without exception in the delegation, that what was on offer from Israel with American brokerage and mediation would not lead to a Palestinian state, would not end the occupation, and would not roll back the settlement process. And those were the Palestinian objectives. I mean, that's why the Palestinians went into the negotiations. That's what they hoped and expected. That's what they were led to believe might be an outcome or would be an outcome. And it became crystal clear to me anyway by 1993, and to I think most of the members of the delegation, that that simply was not on offer. Now, unbeknownst to us, the PLO was negotiating directly with Israel after Yasser Arafat and Prime Minister Rabin agreed to open direct negotiations in Oslo. And basically, the PLO accepted the terms for autonomy and the rest of it deferred indefinitely that had been on offer and had been unacceptable to the delegation that was in Madrid and Washington. And I think that's the problem. Everything was deferred. Nothing was guaranteed. And indeed, we find out later on from things like Prime Minister Rabin's last speech to the Israeli Knesset a few weeks before he was assassinated, where he said, what we were offering the Palestinians is less than a state. So he wasn't willing to give the Palestinians a sovereign, independent, viable, contiguous state. He also said, Israel will maintain security control over the Jordan River Valley. Now, what does that mean? That means that this state would be cut off and controlled by Israel. So it wouldn't be a state. That was Rabin, who made big breakthrough in Israel's understanding of the issue and in Israel's willingness to recognize that the Palestinians are a people, to negotiate with the PLO as the representative of the Palestinians. That was a big step on his part. But he was not willing to go the last mile, at least according to the speech he gave to the Knesset before extremists killed him for going too far. Extremists, by the way, who were ensconced in the current Israeli government, or at least their ideological heirs, are the Israeli government today. I think there are other indications of why this did not work in American policy and in the policy even of those Israeli leaders like Rabin and Barak. Ehud Barak, a later prime minister, or Ehud Olmert, a later prime minister, that this process as crafted could not have led to a viable, contiguous, sovereign Palestinian state. It was not intended to. It was intended to create some kind of autonomous entity under Israel's ultimate control to allow the continuation of the settlement process and to supposedly settle the issue in that way.
So do you think it was just as well that a state was not established that would be shorn of real sovereignty?
Well, it wouldn't have been a state. Statehood and sovereignty are synonymous. It would have been a Bantustan. It would have been an enclave under Israeli control, which is what the Palestinian Authority has developed into. When you say state, you mean you control your borders, your airspace. It means you control your aquifers. It means you control your population register. You control who enters and exits. Israeli control of the Jordan River Valley would not have allowed any of those things.
You've written about the development of a national identity and consciousness among Palestinians. Could you talk about Hamas and where it fits into that national identity? Where do you think the struggle for national liberation is going to go from here after this war finally does come to an end?
I'm very reluctant to try and predict. I say job description of a historian does not include predicting the future. I don't know where it will go. But I think I can answer your first question, which is, where does Hamas come from? Hamas comes from a shift in Palestinian politics that starts in the 1970s, after the 1973 war, where the Palestinians had previously aimed for a secular democratic state, including Jews, Muslims, and Christians in all of Palestine. They shift to accepting the idea of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. And they make other shifts. Eventually, they renounce violence. They eventually accept Security Council Resolution 242. This is a long, tortuous process from the mid-70s until 1988. In parallel to that process, and at the very end of it, Hamas develops and picks up the older slogans. We want all of Palestine, and we believe that violence and armed struggle is the only way to achieve that liberation. So as the PLO moves towards a two-state solution and renunciation of violence, Hamas is established in 1987 out of a desire to maintain that old approach. And the interesting thing is that if you look at the 1990s, Arafat and the PLO were enormously popular among Palestinians. The idea of establishing a Palestinian state along Israel, even though most Palestinians felt that this slighted the Palestinians, they would get 22% of mandatory Palestine. Israel would get 78% or some adjustment of those percentages. They were willing to accept that. A majority of Palestinians were, very clearly. Arafat was popular. The PLO was popular. The Oslo Accords were popular. People thought this would lead to statehood. People thought this would lead to an end of occupation. People thought this would lead to the settlements being shrunk or removed. None of those things happened. In fact, the opposite happened. The military occupation becomes infinitely more intensive as the Oslo process develops. You have checkpoints, you have walls, you have restrictions on movement, you have the creation of little enclaves between which movement is controlled by Israel. That didn't exist before 1993. Anybody could move anywhere in Israel and the occupied territories. Palestinians worked in Israel freely. There was no barrier on entry into Gaza. You could use a car with Palestinian license plates and drive to the Golan Heights, drive to Eilat, drive to Gaza. No restrictions. After Oslo, those restrictions start to be imposed, and people realize this is not leading where we thought it was leading. That's where Hamas gets its strength. You ask, why does the PLO and Fatah lose popularity over the past 30 years? It's because everything they espoused was not achieved. And what does that leave? That leaves the alternative of Hamas, armed struggle, and an absolutist endgame.
What are some of the key misperceptions of Hamas that we're seeing in the media today?
One of them is that this is a universal jihadi Islamist organization. It's not. It's a Palestinian nationalist Islamist organization. Islam is central to their self-conception, but they are Palestinian nationalists. They operate within a realm of Palestine. They're not like the Islamic State, which had universalist aspirations and which was nihilistic. It wanted to destroy the entire regional order, and it tried to do that. And it used terrorist means exclusively to do that. Hamas has both a military wing, which has used attacks on civilians, things that are violations of international humanitarian law, like suicide bombings, but also has a political wing, which has run for elections, which has governed Gaza for a period, and at which at some time, at some stages, appeared as if it might be willing to enter into a two-state solution. In 2006, 2007, when they won the elections, they formed a coalition government with Fatah, which was trying to negotiate with Israel. Israel and the United States refused. Hamas is many things. The idea that it has always been and is some kind of universal Islamist jihadi organization is actually false. It's an Islamist nationalist Palestinian organization whose objectives are entirely limited to Palestine. The other false impression of it is that even though it is correct that it has always argued for violence, in other words, they've always said armed struggle, they have admitted the idea at different stages, or have appeared to admit the idea, that a solution could be negotiated. Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, before the Israelis assassinated him, who is like the spiritual leader of Hamas, argued for 100 years truce with Israel. In other words, stopping the violence. Now, 100 years truce is not peace. He never said he would recognize Israel. The Israelis have all these caveats, but he did say that. Nobody wanted to take him up on that. And that's the interesting thing. It appears that some Israeli leaders would prefer to have Hamas, which can be marginalized and demonized as terrorists, to having a unified Palestinian national movement, which would be willing to negotiate with them. At least that was the option that was available briefly, it seemed, in the early 2000s, 2006, 5, 6, 7. I don't know if that option exists anymore.
Rashid Halady, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Columbia University Professor Rashid Halady, a historian of the modern Middle East, speaking to me November 9th. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine.